The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
It is impossible for me to believe that the White House does not have the capacity to go test the waters on the Hill and to figure out whether or not an authorization to strike at ISIS would pass. It's that they're not even trying. You know, whether there may be trial balloons that are being floated on the Hill, but there's nobody really in the form of, you know, potential legislation that people talk about or potential authorizations that never go anywhere. But it seems to me that nobody from the White House is even trying or even making the effort to go up and find out how would they vote.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, September 12th, 2014. That's the voice of Shane Harris of Foreign Policy Magazine on our roundtable discussion this week of the administration, Congress, the Islamic State, and the decision not to seek an authorization for the use of force before going to war. Shane joined me, Bobby Chesney, and Lawfare's managing editor, Wells Bennett, for a discussion of the politics and law of authorizing force, of war powers, of the administration's decision to go it alone, sort of Congress's decision to avoid a vote, at least for now, and of the consequences of it all for the fight against ISIS. Before we get started, I want to remind you to rate the Lawfare podcast on whatever podcast service you use. Leave a review. Share the Lawfare podcast using social media. Please help do your part to spread the news. It's the Lawfare podcast, episode 91, ISIL, ISIS, IS, AUMF.
We're going to talk about ISIL and about the AUMF that has not been requested for ISIL and about the administration's contention that actually the 2001 AUMF is all it needs. So almost everybody I have read who has, including three people on this call, who have weighed in on the merits of this have disagreed with the administration's position with varying levels of incredulity. I'm one of them. I'm curious, all of you, why do you think the administration has taken this view, and what is the, you know, the best case that can be made for its merits?
So I've been like really trying to puzzle through this today, and I have more questions than I have answers, but I guess the big questions I have at this point as to why they would try to do this. I mean, isn't there, on the one hand, this could be the administration trying to preserve the most unilateral executive authority that it could, you know, that it could find for attacking ISIS, which the administration's official line, by the way, is it doesn't matter if they've been disavowed by al-Qaeda or they're not connected to al-Qaeda, we still see them as al-Qaeda, and that's close enough for the purposes of the AUMF. There is, in talking to colleagues of mine around here too, a strong sense that, at least on the Hill, that there's a chance that if the administration went up and asked for the authority to strike Syria, that it wouldn't get it, which I find hard to believe, since I think the last poll was that more than 70%, or sorry, strike ISIS in Iraq, that more than 70% of Americans are in favor of that. So I, you know, the only thing that I can keep coming back to is this, you know, an opportunity or a chance for the administration is trying to preserve for itself the most unilateral freedom to act. But then what makes this really confusing to me is that in the briefing that the White House did with senior administration officials, or SAOs as they like to be called, you know, about 2 hours before Obama's speech, they said, we feel very strongly that he has the authority to act, but they said, this is a quote, support could take many forms for support from Congress, including potentially a new limited authorization for the use of military force that would specifically address the threat by foes by ISIL. But to be clear, we do not believe that the president needs that new authorization in order to take any sustained action against ISIL. So on the one hand, they're saying, we wouldn't mind if you did give it to us, but on the other hand, we don't really think that we need it. So I'm left with just confusion around this, actually.
I mean, I can guess at the reasons why you would want that, at least in terms of the outcome, why you would take this position. And one of them is War Powers Resolution compliance. If you were running an Article II argument, you would still have to contend with the statute there and its requirements to seek specific authorization or stop the operation. So if you find an argument that says the 2001 AUMF extends to ISIS and that group is tantamount to al-Qaeda for purposes of the old 9/11 law, then you have solved the authorization problem, and then you can be doing the things that Shane was talking about, saying, well, I welcome this authorization, but I don't have to have it. Although, at some level, you know, if you believe that appropriating the funds was going to get you there, I guess maybe there was some thought, and again, I'm just speculating, but there was some thought that you were going to wind up in a situation where the money was going to be appropriated, and that just a statutory theory like this was all you needed to bridge the time in between the announcement by the president and the appropriation of the money.
So this is Bobby, and I want to give the strongest case I can for the administration's theory, which I don't actually find persuasive as you guys know, but it should be articulated as strongly as it can. So here's my shot at it. For starters, IS has changed its name many times. Islamic State is what they'd like to be known as, and it's also a question whether we should be cooperating in that, since we don't actually accept that they are, of course, the legitimate caliphate. Before that, there's ISIS, there's ISIL, but go back further, and what are they? They're al-Qaeda in Iraq. It's Zarqawi's outfit. It's what was once the al-Qaeda presence in Iraq, with which we were sustained conflict for many, many years. At that time, it would have seemed odd to talk about them as not being part and parcel of al-Qaeda, as an associated force engaged in hostilities against the U.S. Of course, we're not at that time anymore. Things have changed in two respects. One, they have famously, within the past year, had a breakup with what remains of the al-Qaeda senior leadership. That is, we are told that Zawahiri ordered them to give way to the al-Nusra Front in certain organizational respects, to stand down, as it were, as to Syria. They refused, flouted Zawahiri's authority, and then announced they're just going off on their own. It is possible that tomorrow we might see a press release or tape saying, well, they've decided to let bygones be bygones, and since IS is so successful, al-Qaeda senior leadership wants to patch it up. And it begs the question, should we let these types of fluctuations determine it, or should we have more of a functional test in which we ask, is this the same organization that until that moment of the breakup was an al-Qaeda-associated force? Now, I mentioned there was a second distinction. The second distinction is that, of course, the United States withdrew from combat operations in Iraq, and maybe there is sort of that break in time in the period of non-interaction between the United States and IS. Maybe that's dispositive. The truth is, I would want to know what presumably only the intelligence officials know about what exactly the level of ramped down relationships were then. Was there really no interaction, or was it the case that throughout the end of the U.S. combat role, AQI, or IS, nonetheless was targeting and attempting to carry out attacks on Americans in Iraq?
Bobby,
yes.
This is Ben. When we were fighting AQI while we had a major troop presence in Iraq, was the authorization for that the 2001 AUMF? Was it the 2002 Iraq AUMF, or was it a hybrid of both?
I think it was, so it's all the above and then some, right? This was multiply determined what the domestic, remember, we're talking here the domestic legal foundation. In our days of combat operations in Iraq, fighting AQI and Zarqawi, I think it's pretty easy to make the case that that came within the scope of the 2002 Iraq AUMF, even though that was not use of force against the Iraqi government, but obviously against a different force. But it flows so organically from the 2003 invasion of Iraq that it seems to me a fair interpretation. At the time, as I said a moment ago, I think you could have fairly said, anyways, the 2001 AUMF picks them up as an al-Qaeda-associated force actually engaged in hostilities against us. The third piece, on top of all that, and I've always wondered if this isn't the cleanest and best way to describe the entire phenomena of associated forces, and that is associated forces that engage in hostilities against us, the Haqqani networks of the world, the Pakistani Taliban, the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan, these forces in Afghanistan that aren't al-Qaeda or the Taliban, but nonetheless are clearly fighting us, and it just seems obvious it must be legitimate domestically to extend the fight to them in response, that's almost more of an Article II theory overlaying on top of the original AUMF theory, an Article II self-defense theory. And that could have been the basis for AQI in Iraq as well.
Couldn't you make the argument now, though, that notwithstanding the murder of Jim Foley and Stephen Sotloff, the two American journalists that were killed by ISIS, that ISIS is not actually engaged in hostilities against the United States? I mean, they are now to the extent that there's an air campaign, I guess. But, you know, they're so distinct from al-Qaeda, it seems to me, now. I mean, up to the point where, you know, ISIS even, you know, has declared itself a caliphate, and it basically has, you know, said that al-Qaeda does not even have a legitimate, you know, position to rule over, you know, over the caliphate now. I mean, it's essentially said, we are so far from you, we don't even recognize you, and you should be bowing down to us. But it's not like ISIS was, you know, attacking U.S. forces. You know, it's not as if they are, and in fact, the best intelligence that the administration says they're putting out there now is that they have no plans to attack the U.S. on the homeland. I mean, Matt Olson even said this in a speech at Brookings a week ago. So couldn't you make the argument that they are actually not an al-Qaeda-aligned group and that they're not really engaged in hostilities against the United States?
So, and to take that a step further, I mean, to say that because they used to be an associated force, they are still and forever an associated force seems to me a little bit like saying after the Sino-Soviet split that China is an associated force of Russia. And that just seems, at some level, there's an empirical reality that the word associated has to not mean not associated, and it can't encompass, you know, repudiated by or broken with. So I'm, you know, skeptical that the fact that they were once associated and the fact that they have some sort of common history gets you into AUMF land, particularly from a president who has publicly complained about the breadth of the AUMF.
Well, then I wanted to
repeal it.
So this is Bobby. Having made the case for the view as strongly as I could, the reason I don't buy it is in part what Ben's saying. The idea that distinct organizations with distinct agendas, and let's be clear about how contrary to al-Qaeda's long-standing position, the IS claim of caliphatehood is. Al-Qaeda has long pledged ultimate obedience not to bin Laden, but to Mullah Omar. Mullah Omar is the one who's supposed to be the commander of the faithful. Far from being obedient to that chain of command, as it were, the IS model is that we've gone beyond that. We now have a caliphate again. Mullah Omar needs to pay obeisance to us if he's going to have any role at all. So there is a clean and clear break that seems very salient. But more importantly, the logic of the extension, there have been a couple of quotes from unnamed administration officials saying that
what's basically going on here is a little bit more amorphous. It's about the bequeathing of the legacy, right, or the heir of the ideology kind of more writ large. By that logic, every single time the militant extreme of the Salafist jihadi movement in any location spins out a well-organized, fairly successful group that says that it's picking up the banners, as it were, and starts flying black flags, it's somewhat hard to see why the AMF wouldn't just show up again, whether it's in Libya or the Sinai or somewhere else. And it won't be enough to say, IS is different, because if you read the organizational history, they used to actually be part of the Al-Qaeda team. This movement is so interconnected socially. If you think about the Libya example and imagine some group showing up in IS-like fashion there, the chances are extremely good that some of the leadership figures will be people that were moving in the Al-Qaeda circle in years past and would provide that hook, or at least provide at least a plausible basis for it. So what it seems to do, the successor theory that's being used here, seems to open up a real risk that the AOMF could be interpreted to apply as long as it's any kind of Salafist jihad target that has some plausible prior ties to Al-Qaeda.
I mean, they call it a successor theory, but it's really a kind of transmigration of the soul theory.
It's the Al-Qaeda-like authorization. Like, you look like Al-Qaeda, you're kind of like Al-Qaeda, and therefore you're covered.
Well, I want to put you on the spot about this.
Well, I was about to put you on the spot, actually, Ben. I was going to ask if there's broad disagreement that the statutory theory is something of a stretch, and whatever the motivations were to adopt it, either discomfort with the Article II theory or motivated by the WPR clock, I guess we haven't talked, and I've been thinking a lot about this myself, and I actually don't know. I mean, I guess everyone sort of hinted at it in the discussion of the elasticity of the AOMF theory, but how bad is this for war powers and the institutional arrangements that comprise war powers? Say, for example, if Congress, there is broad support for this in Congress, and after the midterms or later, either there's an appropriation of money or there actually is an ISIS authorization. And there's this interim period where you have a kind of fuzzy reading of this statute. How bad is that?
I mean, look, it's part of a long-term pattern in which we get out of the habit of respecting, and in Congress's case, it's self-respecting, the role that the legislature is supposed to play in authorizing overseas military activity. And, you know, every time the president says, you know, I really don't need Congress on this, and Congress accedes to that by, you know, not passing something and insisting that its passage was significant in some respect, it gets easier the next time. None of these precedents are ironclad in the sense that these are really about the ebb and flow of practice. It's not an area that's really doctrinally pure at all. But there is a center of gravity to, you know, the behavior of the branches and our expectation of the behavior of the branches. And right now, Congress has adopted the institutional posture. You know, we're not going to tell you how we would vote. We're not going to make any promises. But you have to come to us and risk getting your face punched. And the executive, but they don't actually insist on it. And so the executive in response says, well, no, I'm just not going to bother. And over time, that level of sort of mutual disregard for Congress's traditional role in this space does have the effect of eroding it. And I think Congress is at least as much to blame on this as successive executive branches. You know, John Hart Ely said, you know, that this is a field willingly ceded because accountability is frightening stuff. And I think that's, you know, probably the best single sentence that's ever been written on this subject.
Mm-hmm. I think this also just gives you such a clear window
we talk about dysfunction between Congress and the White House, but it seems to me that this is such a great clear window into just how dysfunctional and broken it actually is. It is impossible for me to believe. You cannot believe that the White House does not have the capacity to go test the waters on the Hill and to figure out whether or not an authorization to strike at ISIS would pass. It's that they're not even trying. You know, whether there may be trial balloons that are being floated on the Hill, but there's nobody really in the form of, you know, potential legislation that people talk about or potential authorizations that never go anywhere. But it seems to me that nobody from the White House is even trying or even making the effort to go up and find out how would they vote. And it seems to me that, especially given that more than 70% of Americans have said they're in favor of airstrikes against ISIS, this should not be a hard question for the White House to get an answer to.
It's part of the problem. This is Bobby here. They know they can at least get the authority. They can get the authority to do at least what they want. And what they're actually really concerned about is that in the process of having Congress put pen to paper and actually passing legislation authorizing force here, they're going to get a whole lot more besides that. And then we'll get beat about the head for not actually using that additional capacity, either for ground troops or who knows how broad the substantive and target scope might be. Do you think that they're afraid to reopen it on that ground?
So in other words, like, they were afraid to go to Congress to ask for permission because they'll say, yeah, do this and more?
Yeah, so they'll say, not only are you authorized to do airstrikes, but Congress hereby authorizes boots on the ground and attack Iran while you're at it. And by the way, any other international terrorist force that could possibly be a problem, you have authority to attack them too.
I don't think that's the reason. I think the reason is the opposite. I think they're spooked by what happened with Syria last year, and that they feel like they got taunted into asking Congress for an authorization, only to have the rug pulled out from under them after they did so. And they believe, and I think I have a lot of sympathy with this belief, that Congress wants to criticize them for not doing enough and then also reserve the right to deny them permission to do the things that they want to do. And, of course, you know, there's probably no single person in Congress craven enough to do, that. But that's the oddity of a collective 535-member body, that those strains can produce different legislative coalitions at different times, and that's very dangerous territory for the White House.
I think I agree with Ben. I think that it's the memory of the Syria, almost campaign a year ago. And what's interesting to me too is we're talking about an authorization to use force against ISIS, but the administration has been very clear that they think they need congressional authorization to arm Syrian rebels. And so one way or another, it seems that, one component of the anti-ISIS campaign is going to be put before Congress, and that they can't escape because they want to take the money from Title 10 and they want to divert from Title 50 operations and use it in Title 10. They want to get the DOD involved. They want to do training in Saudi Arabia. So it does seem that one way or another, Congress is going to weigh in on at least some component of the administration's anti-ISIS strategy. And what's going to be interesting when that debate starts to happen around authorizing money to pay, train, and equip the rebels is the rebel groups are already being very clear that whatever weapons we give them, they are going to use them to fight Assad, not just ISIS. So the question then is the anti-ISIS strategy actually, whether intentionally or not, a regime change strategy in Syria?
So
I'm
sort of switching that around in my mind, actually.
I want to change the focus a little bit. The rebels have said, let me pull up my notes about this, because this actually came up in the call that administration officials did before the president went out and gave his speech. And this was in question when the question was asked to one of these administration officials, who I'm not just – they have real names. I'm just not allowed to say what they are even on a podcast. But the question was, if you're going to start arming the rebels in Syria to fight ISIS, doesn't that run the risk that they will then turn around and try to fight the Assad regime too, and are you okay with that? And the response was, we need to bolster the Syrian moderate opposition to enable it to be able to take –
take and hold ground, pushing out both ISIL and the Assad regime. Like, they're not really, they're kind of burying the lead on this, and it came up, and it was not one of the bullet points they talked about. But it seems to me the administration, at least in the context of this you know, conference call with reporters, is saying if we arm these Syrian rebels and they end up overthrowing the Assad regime, well, that's fine too. And I don't think that's, you know, what's contemplated in asking Congress for the authority to fight ISIS.
So hang on. Let's back up here for a minute, and we say nobody here is expressing comfort with the way the administration is behaving. But we all seem to acknowledge that they're in a difficult predicament and that their interlocutor in Congress is not a helpful or reliable one. So what's the right play for them? Is it to rely on Article 2 authority and start that war powers clock ticking? Is it to rely on Article 2 authority but deny that you're engaged in hostilities because you're just using drones? Is it actually to go to bite the bullet, go to Congress, and take the risk of, you know, having your head handed to you on a platter? Or is it to messily do what they're doing, which is to, you know, claim you don't need anything and hope that Congress will feel the threat of marginalization as a result of that and therefore do something?
Well, I mean, I'll take a stab at that. This is Wells. And this is just one way it could have played. I don't think, you know, nobody sort of looks in terms of domestic legal issues, the initial authorization issues maybe anyway, at Kosovo and thinks, wow, that's something we really want to hang our hat on. But there, you could have done an article. There was, I thought, for a while anyway, I mean, I thought there was an Article 2 basis to be doing the strikes that we were doing, and those are being reported as Article 2 strikes under WPR, and you could have proceeded on that basis with the WPR clock running and gone to Congress, or you could have taken the position that the appropriation of funds was tantamount to authorization, which was actually how it played out in Kosovo. So that's one way of doing it. I'm not sure it would have been any more comfortable or less difficult than this one, but it might have been a little bit, I don't know, just it rings in my ear a little bit differently than trying to fit ISIS into the 2001 AUMF.
What do you think, Bobby?
Well, I think that I think I basically agree with what Wells just said. I think the Article 2 argument was itself, frankly, rather weak, unless and until there is some indication that IS has actually turned its sights towards us and was planning something. I think for all the horrors and brutalities of the slayings of the journalists, I'm not sure we can set the threshold of what triggers national self-defense authority of the president to use further ongoing sustained air power after acts like that necessarily was triggered, although I think that's an interesting argument. It makes it different than before the journalist was killed at any rate. But at a minimum, I would have thought the clever strategy here was simply to seek some funding. The continuing resolutions coming down the pipe over the next, you know, sometime in the weeks ahead, it's going to go through. And one wonders whether they could not simply have quietly asked for some supplemental appropriations to be included there that would have been related to the air campaign. That said, of course, the trick is, they do need to muster political support by having the loud, you know, the big speech given, the appeals for everyone to come together and coalesce around this policy. And so what they've basically done is they've done that part and put off, at least for the moment, by using the AMF argument, hard WPR clock questions. And I think the game is that once you get past the November elections, assuming there hasn't been some catastrophe on the ground that makes it all unpalatable, at that point Congress can step in and clean it up after the fact.
So I want to propose something wildly and perhaps inappropriately political. But why isn't the right answer to this problem to send the bill up to Congress with the authorization that you in fact want and to make clear that in advance of the election, if you do not get what you want on this, you will run ads, the DNC or whatever will run ads in the Senate races of those who are not cooperating, talking about how they're frustrating the national security objectives of the United States and threatening to get us all blown up by ISIS.
I think that's not actually not such a crazy idea. And it would certainly, it seems to me, give the president the ability to say, well, I tried, right? I went and I asked for it, but they won't help me. Or he could blame Republicans again for being obstructionist and say they're willing to even play with the security of the United States just to make me look bad or to make me look foolish. I mean, he's going to go ahead with the airstrikes anyway. I mean, I don't think there's anyone – there's certainly, I can't detect right now, at least not before the elections, any movement on Congress to try and get him to stop the airstrikes. And even though Congress doesn't want to vote for it before the elections, they probably, I think, still think would vote for them. So, yeah, I mean, why not? I mean, he's going to do it anyway. Why not, you know, get some political mileage out of it in the process, especially if he really thinks that U.S. interests are threatened and this is a matter of national security concern, although it seems like his top counterterrorism officials have been trying to deflate that argument as best they can over the past couple of weeks. You know, what's interesting in all this, too, is if you really line up all of the statements from everyone from Kerry to Dempsey to Hagel to Matt Olson about whether we are at war, whether we're not at war, whether it's worse than Al-Qaeda, whether it's the same as Al-Qaeda, whether they are a threat to the homeland, whether they're not, this administration is not on the same page at all. And the one person that you really don't hear very much from in this is Susan Rice, the National Security Advisor. So, I mean, aside from the politics and the optics of this, there is some, seems to me, serious miscommunication and breakdown in just keeping all members of the administration and the National Security Council on the same page, because they don't appear to be.
Bobby Wells, what do you think? Is it time to play politics with ISIL?
Perhaps this will brand me as the most starry-eyed participant in this telephone call, but I would hope that if you take at face value some of the things that have been said by the president, the administration, and Congress, this could be a long conflict, and it could extend into the next president's term. It doesn't involve boots on the ground, but it involves boots on the ground, and Shane alluded just a moment ago to something that, if properly mission correct, could become a regime change situation in Syria. So if you're talking about something of that scale, I would hope there would be more reservations about politicizing it in the fashion that I think, we saw maybe a couple, in the not too distant past. So I would hope that wouldn't be the way it goes.
What do you think, Bobby?
I'll just add that I think that he has got a lot of people who will back him on this who are Republicans, and I wonder if the real problem is the only way to politicize this is to do it in a way that would actually get him out of line with some of his own party's people, and so it may just not be tenable for him. And if I may, I actually want to steer us in a slightly different direction for a second, because there's something else that's parallel to what we've been talking about that's not getting much attention on the legal side, and yet it strikes me as quite odd. Next week, Congress will be back in session, and actually I'm told the GOP members, at least, were told, come back a day early because we need to work on an important part of the president's plan here, and that is a situation where the executive branch is going to Congress. They're saying there's something that's critical to do here for this multi-pronged strategy to fight IS, and we need you to explicitly authorize it. Can't do it on our own. But it's not about the airstrikes. It's the training program. They want passage, both the money and, apart from that, and this is critical, the money, yes, but also explicit authority to engage in a DOD training program for, whoever turns out to be the moderate Syrian opposition that they can get to come to Saudi Arabia for this training. And I've read in at least one source that it's not obvious that the only way they could do this training budgetarily is to get a fresh infusion, that there's money in the Overseas Contingency Operations Fund that could be allocated to this in theory, and that the sudden need to have explicit authority has more to do with the notion that you must have express authority from Congress if you're going to do this training off. And my immediate reaction to that is I must be missing something important, because that training funding piece of it under Title X, that's not my area of expertise. I clearly need to know more about it. There must be something there that's special, though, because how could it be otherwise that we must have explicit authorization for that, but you don't need it in a fresh way for the actual air campaign?
I've got no information on that, I'm afraid. Does anybody else?
No, we've actually been talking about this around the office, too, and it's very confusing to us as well, because before the president gave the speech and it was leaking out that he was going to ask Congress for the authorization to fund Syrian rebels and to equip them, the first question that we had was, isn't this exactly what he said he wanted when he gave his speech at West Point?
Exactly.
You know, there's this $5 billion counterterrorism fund that he's asked Congress to approve. It hasn't yet. It's gotten held up, and I'm not exactly sure why it is, although the Syrian opposition groups have told us that they want it to go through. You can use that to pay for it. In the overseas contingency operations, there's money to do it. So it's confusing to me as to why they think that they need explicit congressional approval for this part of it. When the administration officials gave their background briefing, we didn't get into this much because we were focused more on the airstrikes and less on the Syria component. But that's confusing to me, too. I don't understand what the logic for that is of why they think that they need it. Now, the cynical part of me is that the training is never going to happen. I mean, there's been training going on in Jordan that the CIA has been doing. John Brennan, the CIA director, has been overseeing a vetting of the Syrian opposition, which, by the way, who are the moderate Syrian opposition? Nobody in the administration has been able to tell me. In fact, John Kirby, the Pentagon spokesperson, got asked about this in the briefing either on Friday or Thursday, and the reporter said, well, give us the name of the Syrian opposition leader that you're going to be working with, and he couldn't give it, or wouldn't give it. I think, actually, he couldn't give it. So this, again, is just sort of a mystery to me as to why they feel that they need this component of it. And again, if I'm just being cynical of, here, perhaps let's just say that they think for political reasons that they need to do this, and this is maybe perhaps the one that they care least about. Like, they're not willing to roll the dice with Congress over airstrikes because the administration feels they really have to do airstrikes, but maybe they're willing to roll the dice over funding and arming the Syrian rebels, and if Congress says no, well, we tried because secretly the administration doesn't really care if it arms Syrian rebels or not, and it's something that they've actually been pretty reluctant to do for, the better part of the past year anyway.
Well, I find that actually pretty persuasive, especially if you pair it with the other piece of the hypothetical. If they say yes, then suddenly you have some, quote, buy-in. And even though it's not buy-in on airstrikes, it nonetheless can be sort of added to the mix of authorities here, saying, Congress, I consulted Congress, they engaged, they've authorized a key component of this multi-part strategy, and so we're all rowing our oars in the same direction. Let's move on and talk about other things.
We're going to have to leave it there. On that cheerful note, thank you all for joining us.
Such a happy podcast.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our music, as ever, is performed by the Right Honorable Sophia Yan, who will disapprove of you if you do not spread the word about the podcast on all social media platforms. Share us, like us, retweet us. Take a selfie as you're listening to the Lawfare Podcast. Make Sophia happy. You know what to do. Thanks for listening.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.